TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The peak of world oil production, Thanksgiving Day, 2005. Ken DeFace has spent a lifetime in the oil business and the academic study of petroleum. Born in the middle of an Oklahoma City oil field, he worked at the Shell Research Lab in Houston and then joined the faculty at Princeton University, where he taught geology. After his retirement from Princeton in 1998, Ken DeFace published two books on the subject of peak oil, Hubbard's Peak and Beyond Oil. In his book, DeFace sets out to prove that the peak of world oil production is right now. In part one of this talk, he quoted a Dow Jones report from 2003 that announced that the Saudi Arabian oil fields have peaked. Kuwait, he said, reported their production peak on November 12, 2005. ExxonMobil and Chevron say that it is almost 20 years ago that we found more oil than we burned. And Shell announced that it is retiring from the oil business and going into natural gas. The major oil companies, DeFace says, quote, act as if they know what's going on. DeFace says that the methods that King Hubbard used to accurately predict the peak of United States oil production for the early 1970s can now be applied to world production. Using the King Hubbard formula, DeFace says that at the end of 2005, world oil production dropped below its peak. This, he says, is the most important news since James Watt invented the steam engine, but it is not reported. And for most Americans dependent on oil as the economy's lifeblood, the news goes against the grain of the optimistic belief in eternal abundance and even growth. Whether we now have a hard or soft landing depends on the alternatives that need to be developed within the next 5 years. DeFace has critical things to say about hydrogen, solar, and biodiesel, and he does include nuclear, since he does not see that we will be able to scale down our use. He delivers a stark description of the industrial context in which we need to see our own grassroots efforts for alternatives. The California Institute of Technology in Pasadena invited Ken DeFace to talk about his theory of peak oil at the Lauritsen Memorial Lecture on December 1, 2005. Here's part two of his speech, the section on alternatives to oil.
One of the situations that's happening today is that the major oil companies are taking in tens of billions of dollars per company per quarter on profits from the high price of oil. Now, of course, the Congress is looking over their shoulder saying, how about another windfall profits tax? And Matt Simmons made the sarcastic comment, they don't have a business plan. They've got no idea what to do with those billions of dollars. They're not drilling lots of exploratory wells. They're not building new tanker ships. They're not building new pipelines. They're not building new refineries. Because, in fact, look, if world oil is peaking, you don't need any more tanker ships. You don't need any more pipelines. You don't need any more refineries. So they're sitting on top of all this cash, and so my new cottage industry is writing business plans, imaginary business plans, for major oil companies. And coal gasification is the general thing for this coal gas, water gas, town gas, synthesis gas. And as I mentioned, you can make lots of different products with it. After you gasify this stuff, you have a very limited amount of gas. It's not like a great giant smokestack full of hot exhaust. It's a limited amount of gas, and you can strip out the sulfur, sell it, get paid. You can strip out the mercury if there's mercury. You can sell the carbon dioxide, and I was up in North Dakota a couple of weeks ago. They're selling carbon dioxide from reacting soft brown coal this way to the Canadian oil companies for secondary recovery of oil. It's the most successful way of squeezing the last bit of oil out of an existing oil field is to inject carbon dioxide. And instead of having the Kyoto Accord people on your neck, you're getting paid for the carbon dioxide. Another one, you know, drifting a little further away from the existing oil business, is low-energy agriculture. Now, I insist this is not organic farming. Organic farming, you know, based on organic fertilizers, there's just not that much cow plop in the world. And in fact, 3 billion people have to starve to death, probably 5 billion of the 6 billion in the world would have to starve to death if we cut back to straight organic farming. On the other hand, there are ways to use a minimum amount of fertilizer. And although we can make nitrogen fertilizer using hydrogen from coal, certainly if you can rotate crops with the legume family, alfalfa and beans, that fix their own nitrogen, it's called green manure, great. But in the case of phosphate, look, they can't. There's no source of phosphate. It doesn't come from the air. And the interesting thing there would be careful soil analyses, subdivide the big plots and, you know, try to put on just enough phosphate, use the analytical tools to get by with the minimum. And similarly with pesticides, with diagnostic tools and carefully tuned pesticides, try to use less. Now, the crop types are interesting because it's going to have to focus on products that can be grown locally, stored inexpensively. And I just got in a book on root cellars, which is an old-fashioned concept, storing carrots and potatoes. But amongst other things we're going to have to learn to love are rutabagas and parsnips and turnips, which I hate, but we're going to have to learn to do it. And Berkeley College at Yale has converted to a locally grown thing, and Alice Waters from Berkeley and her daughter have been guiding Berkeley College to a new style. And another interesting thing is if you do have energy involved in irrigation, the criticism of wind and solar is, hey, they don't happen all the time. Well, I don't care which time of day the water comes up to irrigate the field. And, you know, my grandmother had a daisy wheel windmill. We go back to using wind opportunistically to perform functions, you know, for agriculture. So I claim that, yes, the major oil companies could take on domains where energy is now used very intensively and try to re-engineer that whole end of the system. The most technological of the dreams comes from Rick Smalley, Rice University, discovered buckyballs. And after he won the Nobel Prize, he was told, well, you can teach anything you want in the university. And he thought a while and said, energy. Then he got interested in how would you do this? And was trying to develop high efficiency direct current transmission lines, high voltage, low weight bucky tube transmission lines, and local storage. Everybody says, you can't store electricity. And he said, look, you buy a refrigerator-sized gadget down the basement that is your electric storage unit, and if at 4 in the afternoon your air conditioning goes down, hey, we'll sell you a bigger gadget to go in your basement. But it takes away some of the need to have a highly reliable grid. And we can use things where they are at their best. Solar energy, you know, Arizona, Nevada, wind energy, West Texas. Standard wind gauge in Amarillo, Texas is a blacksmith's anvil on the length of chain, and when it starts flapping around, it'll give the winds blowing. So use it where they do the best, and if he could transport electricity very cheaply, great. And in parentheses down at the bottom, I want to have the 3-volt house. The computer wants 3 volts, the LED lights want 3 volts, your new Peltier Effect refrigerator is going to want 3 volts. And so let's just rewire the house for 3 volts, and if the baby chews into the wire, hey, you won't even feel it. Now, I'm getting some help from the religious right, and they are asking themselves, look, if Jesus were alive today, would he be driving around in a little Japanese hybrid? And my son found what is the wrong answer, that I love the line at the top, for God so loved the world that he gave us monster trucks. So that's not the way it goes. Now, part of the debate is, do we have a hard landing or a soft landing? Now, a soft landing, you need to get in place enough new nuclear power capacity, wind generation, efficiency in housing, and efficiency in automobile transportation in place by last Thursday, and we'd have a soft landing, a seamless transition. But it's very likely the longer we go, and the fact that we didn't listen to Jimmy Carter, says that it's going to be a hard landing. The least vicious of the hard landings is a global recession, possibly worse than 1930. And that's, you know, on the one side, and the harder hard landing, I borrowed the four horsemen of the apocalypse, war, famine, pestilence, and death. When I was young, I was told, reading the Bible is a good thing, but don't try to read the last chapter, you'll only get confused. And the four horsemen are out of the book of Revelations, and these are their traditional names. But famine, I talked about, that agriculture is very much at risk, and pestilence, hey, these are petrochemicals, most of the pesticides. Amos Noor at Stanford, geophysicist who's been head of their geophysics section for a number of years, stood up a year ago at the American Geophysical Union meeting and all but predicted war between the United States and China. Now, he said, I don't want war between the United States and China, and I hope by predicting it, somebody will be smart enough to figure out how not to have a war between the United States and China. But his take is that the first three skirmishes in the oil war were the first Gulf War, the World Trade Center, the second Gulf War, the one on now. And in the case of the World Trade Center, it's been largely forgotten. Osama bin Laden's announced purpose was to displace the government of Saudi Arabia. And by taking down the World Trade Center, he showed he was the biggest, baddest Arab on the block and, you know, the logical contender to take over the government of Saudi Arabia. And either that or having Saudi Arabia descend into civil war is just the end. It would disrupt the world so severely that a global recession is sort of built in and guaranteed. So it's a nervous, nervous time. And this last picture is of M. King Hubbard in the 1930s. And I got a letter from a long retired crystallographer who said, oh, I knew Hubbard at Columbia University in the 1930s. He was interested in the oil limit problem even then. So it turns out that very likely Hubbard was watching this thing from the depths of the Great Depression up through 1956. And finally, when the data were complete enough that he could just barely see where the top of the peak was, he pounced, published on it. He had some good luck. It could have been actually an earlier peak than the one he predicted, but he hit it, you know, right on the nose, became a folk hero. So, and this picture from the 1930s looks like he was no easier to get along with than he was later. Thank you.
That was the conclusion of a lecture by Ken DeFays, Professor Emeritus at Princeton University. Students and guests at the California Institute of Technology, where he spoke in early December 2005, lined up at the aisle microphones. Here's the first question.
I was kind of curious what types of things might make you adjust your prediction for the 2005?
Oh, yes. Major thing would be new discoveries, field extensions, new oil, you know, being pumped into the system, being found for the system. That's not happening. And that, more than anything else, would change the picture. Now, the point of the Chevron ads is to say, come join us, let's open up all these areas for drilling. But they are not really showing that even if they were all opened up, profitable though it might be for the companies involved, the world wouldn't be very much closer to a solution. So I think we have to say safety is on the side of presuming that we're not going to have a sudden burst. I mean, the best thing that could happen would be the six countries around the South China Sea sit down and sign an agreement to divide the oil up some way, and we start exploring the South China Sea. It's been mostly natural gas around the edges. but that's the last major place on Earth that hasn't been explored.
You mentioned that you don't know why the diesel, high-efficient diesel engines aren't used in the United States. And you also mentioned the Manhattan Project and Apollo Project for possible alternative energy sources. But the issue that you raise about it not being economically feasible to transition to, say, solar or whatnot, but isn't it the imperative of the government when you have something like alternative energy whereby the federal government could invest in it and create a situation where it's cheap off the shelf for bettering our world?
Part of it is, for instance, the hydrogen-powered fuel cell automobile. And it's on a lot of people's lists, and a lot of manufacturers are showing, you know, slinky exteriors of automobiles ready for fuel cells. But right now, the platinum that goes into catalyzing the fuel cells is the order of $1 million a car. And I heard a lecture recently by a guy from Ballard, which is the leading manufacturer, and somebody asked about platinum. He says, oh, we think we can cut it down in half. $500,000. And I claim the great profit center in the hydrogen-powered car is going to be stealing automobiles. So I think there's some of these which no amount of well-intentioned engineering is going to get you something that you can use on a time scale that we need.
You have people like Willie Nelson opening biodiesel stations. I mean, is that a future? I mean, what's going to happen with biodiesel? What do you see there?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of what's sold as biodiesel now is biodiesel 9, meaning it's 90% petroleum and 10% soybeans. And people drive around saying, see, I'm driving on biodiesel. Oh, come on. And there apparently is one filling station in Berkeley where you could buy 100% biodiesel. You pay quite a lot extra for it, but, you know, you feel good for having done it. Part of the problem is we got 6 billion mouths to feed, and that number is going up fast, and we may need all that bio to eat for lunch.
For the last 3 years, I've been driving a Toyota RAV4 EV, and I have solar panels on my house that I bought for about $8,000 per kilowatt. And if I amortize the cost of those over their lifetime, it costs me about 50 cents per gallon equivalent to drive my car. Today, with nickel metal hydride batteries and even the better lithium ion batteries, you can build electric vehicles that travel over 300 miles on a charge. You can fast charge them in 5 minutes. And you can use off-peak power at 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour through most of the nation to charge these cars. The problem is getting the auto companies to build them. So what we need is a political leader who is willing to force this issue. The only reason I have my car is because California passed the zero emission vehicle mandate in 1990 and forced the auto companies to build them. They built 5,000. They took 4,000 back and crushed them until we stopped them from doing that. There are 1,000 of these vehicles left, and they're testament to the fact that this technology works, and it works today. I don't drive with any pollution. I drive with sunshine.
Well, wait a minute. You have but you got your own solar cells.
Yes.
So you're not plugging it into the grid.
No, I plug into the grid. I charge during night when there's off-peak surplus power. My solar panels are
Yeah, but
feeding.
You're still polluting Arizona.
No.
When you plug that thing in Los Angeles.
Okay. All right, hold on, because this is an issue, and you need to hear the truth here. The truth is my car will travel 3 miles on 1 kilowatt hour of power. If you take the amount of pollution that's generated to get that kilowatt hour into my battery and compare that to driving 3 miles with the cleanest gasoline hybrid, it is less pollution.
Okay.
And the fact that I'm generating power during the peak hours of the day, I'm offsetting very dirty coal plants during the day, and I charge at night with cleaner power. So don't believe it that electric cars are dirtier than gas cars. They are not.
Today I attended an energy meeting in downtown Los Angeles. One of the speakers spoke of an additional petroleum energy source, or actually two sources, albeit flawed. One, tar sands in northern Alberta. Two, shale with oil in the western U.S. How flawed do you think these sources are, and how substantial do you think they are?
In the case of the Alberta tar sands, They are currently close to being natural gas limited. They're heavy users of natural gas, and the NAFTA agreement requires the three countries in North America to observe their historic sales patterns so that Canada's obligated to sell gas to the U.S., the U.S. is obligated to sell gas to Mexico. As things run short, are the Canadians going to sit in the cold and the dark and continue to sell gas to the U.S.? No, you know, the NAFTA agreement comes unglued. So the situation with the tar sands is not just, you know, a wide open, here it is, take as much as you want. They're natural gas limited now. They can re-engineer their way around that. They are water, heavy water users. They use 3 barrels of water to get 1 barrel of oil. They can recycle some of the water, but the Canadian thing may be limited. And I have a chapter on tar sands and a chapter on oil shale in Beyond Oil. The oil shale is a long ways from being successful right now. When you retort the oil shale, it fluffs up. You can't poke it back in the hole you mined it out of. You're going to have to commandeer a canyon somewhere and start filling it with spent shale. So it's not on the horizon right now. Shale's giving it another try, but there are several $1 billion worth of equipment rusting in the Colorado sunshine right now from the last oil shale.
How high do you think the price of crude has to rise before it's economical to make gasoline out of coal?
I think we've been there. That technology is well known. It's the Fischer-Tropsch process. It dates from before World War II. And when the South Africans were cut off from world oil, they made gasoline from coal. And that plant's still operating, but it's making petrochemical feedstocks nowadays. But I think we're there.
So I just want to engage you on the soft landing versus hard landing issue. If I understand correctly, we currently spend about 2 to 2.5% of world GNP on energy of all types. If that's true, then a large part of the problem, given all the externalities of energy, and oil in particular, is that energy is too cheap. That if the price of energy doubles, we'll start doing all sorts of things that are going to make all of our uses a lot more efficient. So in that sense, it seems to me that the Hubbert's Peak is a great blessing. If we increase the price of oil to over $100 a barrel, that's not really something the world economy can absorb, but that's going to lead to all sorts of productive changes in how the economy is organized.
Well, even if the U.S. can absorb, I'm worried about the farmer in Kenya who can't absorb much, that they're just barely making it right now. And try it as a third world farmer and see whether it's as much fun. And I suspect it is not, that people start starving to death if you squeeze too hard on the price of energy.
Right, but isn't it the price that's going to cause the changes that will
I have this running battle with economists. They think price is everything, and I think supply and where do you get it and how easy is it to get it and can we find a more efficient way of using phosphate fertilizer? You know, I was a geological engineer as an undergraduate, and the only course I took in economics, I didn't understand. I didn't feel I had my hands around it, so I don't know. I mean, I don't have any expertise in that.
A few minutes ago, in answer to another question, a remark of yours slipped by, and it was about the fact that you are more sanguine about what we'll have available to us in terms of new technologies maybe 10 to 15 years from now, but you're quite scared about what's happening in the next 5. Could you be more vivid for us about the next 5?
Well, see, there are several scenarios. If you look up Amos Neuer's website by typing Amos, N-U-R, Neuer on Google, and click on oil and war, you know, there's one view of what can happen in the short run. Another kind of argument, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but another argument says, why are we in Afghanistan of all the funny places? Because it has a border with China and a border with Iran. It's the sole barrier to the Chinese building a pipeline straight to the Middle East. I even looked up on maps.google at the boundary between Afghanistan and China. It's not that rough. I could get a pipeline through there in a long summer. So there are short-run hazards that we're not in very good control of. The 15-year time scale. Oh, but somebody mentioned earlier in a question, political leadership. I think we're desperately in need of another Winston Churchill or John Kennedy to stand up and say, look, this is a tough problem, but we're tough people. We're going to do it.
I don't think that either political party, which seems to be operating off of sound bites that you hear in the, you know, that you see on television by the talking heads, neither a political party seem to have the political will right now to do anything. The two things that you mentioned the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit to limit our use. You also mentioned using more nuclear generations. Those are, what, 10, 15 years down the pipeline. Other things like CAFE standards to limit the consumption of gasoline as opposed to the big SUVs and that kind of thing.
Well,
I don't see the political will by anybody.
Oh, no, you're quite correct. And Senator Kerry, had he been elected, might have represented as difficult an education problem as President Bush, because Kerry would say in his standard campaign speech, we don't want to be beholden to the Saudi royal family. We want to be energy independent. Big applause. Then his staff would say, sir, you can't deliver on that. And the other half of the staff said, so what? It gets a big applause. Leave it in. Well, had Kerry been elected, we'd have had the same education problem.
Right. I mean, nothing would be different from the energy.
You know, the one exception is Representative Roscoe Bartlett from Maryland, who's been giving speeches, running meetings, trying to get the story out, and he's as frustrated as the rest of us.
That was a lecture and answers to questions by Ken DeFaze, Professor Emeritus at Princeton University. He was recorded by the LA Sound Posse at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena in December 2005. DeFaze has spent a lifetime in the oil business and the academic study of petroleum and is the author of two books, Hubbard's Peak and Beyond Oil. He writes that we reached the peak of world oil production at the end of 2005. DeFaze is maybe even better known as the amiable mentor and travel guide through Nevada and California to John McPhee when he was describing the geology of North America for his books Basin and Range and Assembling California. You can find more information on Ken DeFaze on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order an audio copy of the complete 60-minute talk by Ken DeFaze by calling us. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to get the audio tape or CD. You can place your order by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.